Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club, the place where you're in the know. I'm Dr. Kit Yarrow. I chair the psychology department at Golden Gate University, where I'm a professor of psychology and business, and I'll be your moderator for this program. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org, or you can download our iPhone or Android app for program information and to register for programs. And now it's my very distinct pleasure to introduce today's distinguished guest, Joshua Kendall. He's a journalist, associate fellow at Yale University's Trumbull College, and author of the new book, America's Obsessives, The Compulsive Energy That Built a Nation. I loved this book. I can't wait for you to read it. You're going to love it, too. I found it to be a really fascinating and psychologically astute glimpse into both the public and emotional lives of seven diverse American heroes. While you might be in awe of Ted Williams' swing or envy Estee Lauder's mansions, you wouldn't want to be them, and you'll find out all about how and why as in this upcoming presentation. Okay, and so without further ado, our guest, Joshua Kendall.
Thank you very much, Kit, and it's a pleasure to be here. When my book came out around 6 weeks ago, I wrote a piece for Slate in which I summarized the key ideas, and that piece was called Madness Made Them Great. And underneath that, I was talking about how hard work and intelligence can take you only so far, but to be super successful, you also need that maniacal overdrive. Now, We know, based on research for a half century, that a touch of madness can be an asset for poets and artists. Without her suicidal depression, Sylvia Plath wouldn't have entered the canon of world literature. Her suicidal depression was her brand. And you can't be suicidally depressed and start Apple, but you can have what I call the superachiever's disease. And that's obsessive compulsive personality disorder, which I'll be talking about today. So I want to look at great American achievements and show that behind these achievements, in the Sturm und Drang that created these achievements, was a human being and his struggle with mental illness. And we'll start with the iPhone, then we'll go to the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson. Another chapter is on Henry Heinz, the man who turned ketchup into our national sauce. Then I have a chapter on Melville Dewey and the Dewey Decimal System. And you might think Melville Dewey was just a kind of futzy 19th century librarian. But if you think about it, Melville Dewey was really the Sergey Brin of the 19th century. He was organizing printed matter. He was giving researchers access to printed matter. And before Dewey came out with the Dewey Decimal System in 1876, libraries were a mess, and you couldn't do systematic research. And there are very few footnotes before the age of Melville Dewey. And that's exactly what Sergey Brin is trying to do, especially in the Google Library Project. So, I'm choosing people in different fields. So you're going to have a politician, Thomas Jefferson, a marketing expert, Henry Heinz, an IT guy, Melville Dewey, Ted Williams with his 400 batting average. And when you think Ted Williams, you might also think about someone like Tiger Woods and other athletes. And the first manned airplane across the Atlantic, that's Charles Lindbergh. So we're going to go behind the invention, and we're going to start with Steve Jobs. And it's a pleasure to be here in California because my book starts in Fremont, California, in 1984, when a fellow named Steve Jobs gets on his landline, and that's all there was back then. And on a Sunday morning at 8 a.m., he calls his assistant and says, "I'm on my way to the factory. Meet me there." and he hops into his black Mercedes to make the 45-minute trek from his home in Woodside to Fremont, where Apple's churning out its latest product, the Mac. And on the receiving end of that phone line is Debbie Coleman, the company's head of manufacturing, and she's reading the Sunday paper, and I interviewed her, and she says, "I was less surprised by the timing of Steve's call than by what I saw when I got there." And Steve is interested in going to the factory on Sunday morning because he wants to show his adoptive father, Paul Jobs, the new factory, and he's very proud of it. And after deciding that the initial site, Dallas, Texas, would not do, Jobs became consumed with every detail. He wanted to bring to America the elegantly designed machines that he had seen in Germany, such as Braun appliances and BMW cars. But his focus went way beyond hiring state-of-the-art equipment. He insisted that the walls all be painted white. No white was too white for Steve. He would also don white gloves to do frequent dust checks. Whenever he spotted a few specks on either a machine or on the floor, which he was determined to keep clean enough to eat off, his assistant had to arrange for an instant scrubbing. So this is that maniacal overdrive. And then he and his father go around the factory. And his father, who had supported the family by working as a repo man, was also a bit of an obsessive nut. And while his father was impressed by how everything worked, Coleman told me, he asked a lot of questions. He, too, paid attention to details. I also interviewed Pam Kerwin, who was the marketing director at Pixar during Jobs' hiatus from Apple. And Pam told me he was a control freak and perfectionist in all things. He would carefully go over every document a million times and would pick up on punctuation errors, such as misplaced commas. Commas, cleanliness, Jobs could obsess and go ballistic about minutiae that would not even register on the radar screen of most CEOs. And he has this obsessive compulsive personality, which I'll describe in a second. Just a last thought about Jobs. He did not design insanely great products just to build a great company. He built a great company so that he could keep designing insanely great products. This was something that mattered more to the adult Jobs than life itself. When the sedated cancer patient was lying in his hospital bed, he once ripped off his oxygen mask, railing that he hated its design. Much to the surprise of his doctors, Jobs then ordered them to begin work on 5 different options for a new mask. So this is the maniacal overdrive, and for some reason, this touch of madness is going to go hand in hand with the energy that's going to allow him to revolutionize 7 industries, as we all know. All right, now I want to talk a little bit about what obsessive-compulsive personality disorder is. It's not the same as OCD. People use the term, "I have OCD, I'm going to go clean up my kitchen and scrub the floor 1,000 times." OCD is very paralyzing. People with OCD often can't leave the house. They're afraid the burner is going to go off. They're obsessed with cleanliness, but their obsessions paralyze them. People like Jobs, their obsessions, they thrive on cleanliness. Another way of putting it is that those with OCD seek psychiatric treatment, but those with the personality disorder, as you'll find out, drive other family members to seek treatment. They also drive staff members, the underlings at their office, to seek treatment. They're very tough and inflexible, and they're supercharged, but they're kind of a cousin to those with OCD. And OCPD is not the same as Asperger's syndrome, which is on the autistic spectrum. And to give you a sense of that, I'll tell you about Charles Lindbergh. Charles Lindbergh, as you'll learn from my book, had a wife, Anne Lindbergh, in Connecticut, and had 3 long-term German mistresses with whom he fathered 7 children. He also had, now if you have 4 wives, when are you going to have any fun? So Charles Lindbergh also had girlfriends. He had a stewardess who was 30 years younger. So we're really talking about a Tiger Woods here. And by the way, there's this weird link between cleanliness and sexual compulsivity. And a decade before all the sex stuff came out with Tiger Woods, Tiger Woods told Oprah that he irons his shirts after they come back from the cleaners. So these are people who care about cleanliness, but also can have other kinds of quirks. Now, to get back to Asperger's, people with Asperger's, what you see is what you get. They're very shy, and they're kind of related to the OCPDers. But now to go back to Lindbergh, people with OCPD are more fragmented. They have a charming self. They have kind of a sexy self that can have the affairs. But people with Asperger's have a lot of the same characteristics, but what you see is what you get, and they'll be shy in all situations. They often have trouble going out on a date. But the OCPDers, again, they're cousins, but not the same. And one of the things I found in OCPD is that the folks often have a harsh early life. And when we think of OCPD, those of you who remember the show The Odd Couple and Felix Unger, he was a follower. He wasn't going to start Apple. But I come up with this category called the obsessive innovator to say that those who are obsessed with order and cleanliness and rules and lists, that they also have the potential to be leaders, and they can be innovators. And people tend to think of them, like Felix Unger, as kind of nerdy, passive people, but they can have tremendous capacity for leadership. All right, the key symptoms, and I'm using DSM-4, they're control freaks. And they love details, rules, order, lists. They're perfectionists. Now, these are all characteristics that are going to make social relationships hard. Not so much for them, but for others, like their children or their wives, or in Lindbergh's case, literally their wives. make them hard. But this is also the skill. This is also the Apple credo. These characteristics are an asset in the workplace. And that's why psychiatry describes it as a disorder. These folks have interpersonal problems. They have trouble connecting, but they function better than well in the workplace. All right, I'm going to start with Ted Williams from my town, hometown now of Boston. I say that he perhaps died in 2002 because, as hardcore baseball fans know, part of his brain was frozen, and some of his DNA may still be around in Arizona. And to give you a sense of the harsh early life, he said, "I only live for my next time at bat." Ted Williams was actually the first great Hispanic baseball player. His mother was Michaela Vinzor. He grew up in San Diego, and she was known as Salvation May. And she was never at home. She would be out day and night on the bus trying to save the town's drunks and prostitutes. One of those people with an alcohol problem was his father, Samuel Williams, and Ted Williams bonded with the bat the way Linus and Peanuts bonded with the blanket. And home plate was a substitute home. And as a little boy, all he did was think about baseball, and he was able to channel his obsessionality into this great career. Now think of his brother. He had a brother, Danny, in San Diego, who was known as San Diego's number one juvenile delinquent. And Ted Williams, he didn't have athletic skill. He was 5'4". So that's a sense that he had this harsh early life, and he hung on to something that he really loved, baseball, and he thought about it all the time. Ted Williams, during his baseball days, he would make an annual pilgrimage to the Louisville Slugger Factory. He would slip the lathe operator a $20 bill. In the 1940s, when the head of the bat factory died, he was the only player in all of Major League Baseball to wire condolences to the family. It's like someone else losing their drug dealer. I mean, losing the head of the bat company was a big deal for Ted Williams. In terms of his innovation, Ted Williams, today there, people know about the field called sabermetrics, where you look at the numbers in baseball. If you've seen Moneyball about the Oakland A's, Ted Williams was doing all of that without a computer. So this wasn't a Felix Unger, but this was a guy rethinking how to hit. Babe Ruth was a power hitter who was half drunk and would get up there and swat a home run. But Ted Williams was calculating every inch of the strike zone. He wouldn't swing at a pitch a quarter of an inch outside. And he was using, he called it hittingology. And he said, "Well, I wasn't much of a student, but baseballically I was a cum laude." And he was. All right, the next obsessive, I'm going to talk about Estee Lauder. And that chapter is called The Woman Who Couldn't Stop Touching Faces. Now, Estee Lauder wants you to think that she's an European aristo. She's actually a Jewish girl from Queens, New York. Her real name was Josephine Esther Menzner. And her obsessions often start in childhood, and she was the daughter of Hungarian immigrants. Her mother had six children with a first husband, and then she's in New York speaking just Yiddish, and her husband leaves her, and then she's by herself. Miraculously, she finds another Hungarian immigrant, and she has two more kids, one of whom is Este. There's only one problem. Husband number two is 10 years younger. So the mother gets up as soon as the husband goes to work and starts this elaborate beauty ritual. At age three, Estee Lauder is helping her mother put on the makeup, and she does that for the next 90 years. She can't stop. As I joke in the chapter, her business was, think of Jobs and insanely great products. She can't stop. Her business was her alibi. Without her business, she might have been arrested for assault with deadly face powder or something. I interviewed her granddaughter, and in the 1970s, her granddaughter went with Estee to a parent-teacher conference, and the teacher got a makeover. When Rose Kennedy came for tennis, she came for tennis and a makeover. Now, and that's the business paradigm, so that she channeled it into this billion-dollar business, and now the company touches more than half a billion customers around the world. All right, the heart of the book is the secret sex maniacs, because I found that obsessionality often goes with sexual compulsivity. If you want any more evidence of that, just take a look at New York City politics. Anthony Weiner, he was the guy, he told his wife that he's going to have to do the laundry, and he hasn't let her near the laundry. And that's again, and psychiatrists have referred to these obsessives as living machines, as rabbits. So Lindbergh had a lot of lovers, but for him, sex was like going to the gas station or something. And think of Williams and his bat, or Jobs and the iPhone. These folks are closer to machines than they are to people. And Charles Lindbergh, I wrote a piece for the New York Times about, people don't know this, but that in 1953 he won the Pulitzer Prize for his autobiography when he writes about his flight to Paris in 1927. And he writes in that book, I'll organize a flight to Paris. Remember, rules, order, and lists. He uses that to hop across the Atlantic on a piece of wood. His childhood is very lonely, and he grows up in Washington. His parents can't stand each other, and that's, again, this harsh early life. He and his mother live in a rooming house. His father is separated, and his father is a womanizer, and his mother has to pay neighborhood kids to play with Charles. And again, the greatest love of his life, as I wrote in a story for the Daily Beast, was the Spirit of St. Louis, was a plane. When he arrives in Paris in 1927, he arrives about 11 o'clock at night, and then he's separated from his plane, and he can't go to sleep until around 4 o'clock. He has to have a little FaceTime to kind of tuck his plane in. He has kind of a separation anxiety that he writes about in his memoir. And he had these three secret German families in the 1950s. So in the 1920s, he's making lists to fly across the Atlantic. In the 1950s, he's making lists to feed his sex addiction. And how's this? I mean, for a writer, it's hard to resist this. He calls himself Clark Kent, is a guy who likes to fly. And his pseudonym in Germany is Clark Kent. He'll fly to Frankfurt, park his car at the Frankfurt airport, and spend a week with each of his German families. And he does this four times a year for about 15 years. And here's the apartment in Munich where Lindbergh, I visited in the fall, where he met the first German mistress. And this is the apartment. And he had I interviewed his eldest. These are three of his German children. And I interviewed the eldest, the fellow on the right there, Dirk Hessheimer. And I talk about them more in the book. All right, Alfred Kinsey. Alfred Kinsey has really been in the news. He wrote the two sex surveys in the 1940s and the 1950s, one about men, one about women. And he's really been in the news for the last few months because there really would be no gay marriage laws without Alfred Kinsey. That was his project. What he was trying to do in the 1940s that took tremendous courage, just like it took courage for Lindbergh to fly across the Atlantic on a piece of wood, was to make sex, whatever happens behind closed doors, as long as there isn't children or force involved, he wanted to make that legitimate. And he preferred sex with men. In fact, he had sex with all of these men on his staff, and I talk about in the chapter about how there were wild orgies in the attic of his house. And I interviewed this fellow, Paul Gephardt, fellow with the mustache, and Paul Gephardt is 95, and Kinsey had various sexual perversions. He liked S&M, and that's in the vocabulary because of Kinsey, and he channeled his obsessionality, and Gephardt said, well, if you're a sex researcher, perversions are the name of the game. But he was an innovator. He was very quirky, but he did something that's really consistent with our democracy of expanding rights for people in the bedroom. And just a little bit about his life. As a boy, he bonded with bugs and snakes. Steve Jobs was also loved snakes as a teenager. And here's what they said in his high school yearbook. On entering his room, one never knows whether Mr. Kinsey or a large body snake is going to greet him. And he becomes an entomologist, and then eventually he transfers from insect to human material. And in his reports, he has a section on animal contacts, animal sexual contacts. And Lionel Trilling, the literary critic, said that's the most tender part of the Kinsey Report, is the bit about sex with animals. He had data showing that about 70% of farm boys had sex with animals. And again, these are folks who don't connect with others. For him, sex was very mechanistic. And I love what his wife said about him to Life magazine in the late 1940s. I hardly see Alfred at night anymore since he took up sex. And Melville Dewey's my favorite. He's the cutest, and he even liked to sleep decimally. So he's coming out with the Dewey Decimal System in 1876. He also establishes the world's first library school. Now he's a secret sex maniac, because he is another Bob Filner. He's a serial kisser and hugger, and he's essentially kicked out of the American Library Association at around 50, and he starts the world's first library school at Columbia in the 1880s, and people have argued that's a way to smuggle babes onto campus. Dewey's theory was you can't polish a pumpkin, and he asked for the photos of the women on the applications. And he also starts Lake Placid, where the Olympics were held, and everything about Lake Placid is tens. The annual fee is 10, and lights out are 10. And everything in his life was about 10, and that was the way he also organized books. All right, just quickly about my other two obsessives, and then we'll go to the questions. Henry Heinz, Heinz Ketchup. He also had a clean factory in Pittsburgh. Now, Heinz Ketchup was the brand that Warren Buffett snapped up for $28 billion a few months ago. These folks know something about that cleanliness. His factory in Pittsburgh was a must-see tourist destination from around 1900 to 1950. Think of Steve Jobs and the cleanliness. And he loved factoids. And think of his famous advertising slogan, 57 varieties. That was just made up. There were actually about 65 varieties at the time. But he just loved counting random numbers. He would carry a tape measure with him at all times, and when he saw an unsuspecting doorway, he would measure it. And 57 doesn't mean anything. He saw a sign in New York for 21 styles of shoes, and he said, "Oh, 57, 57." But it worked. And then Thomas Jefferson, my last obsessive. Thomas Jefferson, the obsessives, they don't have the capacity for self-reflection. And here's what Jefferson told his daughter: "A mind always employed is always happy." And you see the two sides of Jefferson, both the brilliance and the quirkiness in the Declaration of Independence itself. In the preamble, the first 200 words, or perhaps the most famous 200 words written on this side of the Atlantic, reflect his brilliant writing. At college, he would study 10 to 15 hours a day, and he was an obsessive wordsmith, and every single syllable counts, and he was brilliant. But at the same time, the second part of the Declaration is really quirky. It's a meandering list. People forget about that, and they don't cite it on July 4th. But the second part of the Declaration is a list of King George III's 27 crimes. Even John Adams thought it was a bit ridiculous. And this shows you, again, and I don't want to diminish the brilliance and the creativity of any of these individuals, but that they have these various sides. And some of the sides are just a bit maniacal and quirky. And that's amazing that it's really in the Constitution. Jefferson was another list maker. He kept track of every cent that he ever spent. And also, while he was president, he had a mega chart. While he's on the, you know, our dime as the taxpayers, he had this mega chart of the 29 vegetables and 7 fruits in the Washington, D.C. area, and when you could get tomatoes the earliest in a given season. And again, that's a little bit maniacal. That's not something that you really need to do when you're president. And he had a very organized post-presidency. He's like a pre-Dewey Dewey. He organizes his books and labels them and spends months on them, sending them to the Library of Congress. And he also starts the University of Virginia, which is a way to organize knowledge. Think of again, Google, or think of Dewey. But he's an obsessive, so he also controls everything. And even though he's, you know, retired and is in his 80s, he's deciding how many hours a week professors should teach, 6 hours a week, and when the class schedule should be held. So I think I want to stop there and open up the forum to questions.
Okay. Well, our big thank you to Joshua Kendall, journalist, associate fellow at Yale's University Trimble College, and author of the new book, America's Obsessives, The Compulsive Energy That Built a Nation. And so now we're going to start our question and answer period. And I think probably a lot of people would like to know how you picked this crew and maybe who got rejected.
Yes. What I really want to do is start a national conversation that this is a standard path to greatness. It's not the only path to greatness. You can be sweet to your kids and wife or partner or whatever, but it's a standard path to greatness. And I wanted to show in various fields. So once I had a businessman like Henry Heinz, I wasn't going to look for John Rockefeller, although he was also a list maker. And I really want to start a conversation that I want readers to think about people for themselves, but I chose these various categories of politics, marketing, sports. And again, when you see Ted Williams, you might think of Tiger Woods or aviation or beauty. And what I did to find them was to read biographies. And I wanted to find women. It was harder to find women, not that women can't be as obsessive, although men tend to be a little bit more so, but that women didn't really have access to power as much. They couldn't control other people until the last half century when they had a lot more access to higher education. And to give you a sense of a woman whom I tried but who didn't quite fit is I thought about Julia Child. You think of Mastering the Art of French Cooking. That's an obsessive compendium. But a little obsessionality can be good, but she really wasn't over the top. And I went to Radcliffe, the Schlesinger Library at Harvard, where her papers are held, and I read the correspondence between her and her husband, and it was too tender. She was tender not just with an animal like Kinsey, but with another human being, and she seemed too normal. To be a kind of, she didn't have that maniacal overdrive. She had, again, if you're a surgeon, you want to be a little bit obsessive, but you don't want to rip off your oxygen mask if you're on your deathbed. But these are folks who would do that. And Julia Child didn't seem to have that maniacal side to her.
Perfect. Thank you. So I think a lot of people also want to know, when would somebody's obsessive personality disorder become so debilitating that they really couldn't function no matter how bright?
Yes. Basically, my folks, the 7 people I profile, or the 8 including Jobs, they were able to channel it into greatness. But that's not to say that they can't, that they often didn't come to close to a nervous breakdown. Henry Heinz was close to a nervous breakdown on many occasions, and he had to retire at around 50. And at the age of 50, his son insisted that he go to Germany for the last 20 years of his life every summer to chill out at a German sanatorium. That was probably as much for his son's health,
yeah.
to get rid of him, as for his father's. And Kinsey had some setbacks, the McCarthy era, kind of kicked in, and he had trouble funding his research and kind of worked himself to death and dies of a heart attack at age 62. So they're always on the edge. And for them, work is like therapy, but sometimes they can get too much therapy. Sometimes they can Kinsey takes a trip to England to relax, and he's up till 3 a.m. counting the number of prostitutes in Piccadilly Circus. So they just can't stop, and they can drive themselves crazy. So they're always close to the edge. But if they're on one side of the edge, they can lead to greatness, and the other side of the edge can lead to early death or a really serious bout with mental, really being sidelined by their mental illness.
Right. I don't think you're saying this, but just to clarify, obsessiveness isn't something that's required for greatness, though, right? Could you expand on that a little bit?
I'm saying that what I want to start in this national dialogue is that this is one path to greatness that hasn't been looked at. Like Malcolm Gladwell wrote the book Outliers, where he says that if you give Bill Gates 10,000 hours of computer time as a teenager, you might get Microsoft 20 years later or 10 years later. But what I want to add is this element of the irrational, that there's something about success that people can just be a little bit mad and that somehow they, at the same time, they can be successful. But it doesn't have to be that way, but that it does seem that this is a standard path for greatness. And one of the reasons, and this is one of the reasons it's called America's Obsessives, is that we live in such a competitive culture. And if all you can think about is touching faces, you might have a leg up on some other lady who's starting a beauty business. And that's what I wanted to emphasize.
Has our competitive culture resulted in any other disorders that you think are contributing to success? And actually, that's a leading question because I'm also interested in what we spoke about earlier on.
Right. Yeah. It does seem that having a character disorder, and I guess we were talking about narcissism, but having a character disorder can often be, and obsessive compulsive personality disorder is one of several character disorders. Others are like narcissistic personality disorder. And what I'm saying is that in the workspace, these character disorders can sometimes be an asset. Mm-hmm. And that's disturbing, and that's saying something about what's missing in our culture. And there's kind of a crisis now. In Asian cultures, for instance, there's more of a sense of connection, and you want to save face. But in our culture, eccentricity is often to your advantage and makes you stand out. And if you're very demanding, and if you think different, you might do very well.
So several people have questions about whether or not, in your opinion, Martha Stewart, Paula Deen, and Ben Franklin.
Yes, this is exactly the kind of conversation. I'm always reluctant to like to talk about dead people because I don't like to get
sued. It's safer too.
And Steve Jobs is dead. But certainly that's exactly the kind of conversation, and I don't know, obviously I know the basics about Martha Stewart, but I would want to investigate her further, and Ben Franklin, and that's, again, that this is all around us, and we think of these people as hardworking and smart, which they are, but what I'm trying to add again is that maniacal overdrive, and that might have made her into this media sensation.
Do you think Steve Jobs' obsessive personality had something to do with his reaction to medical treatment, his initial refusal?
Yeah, I think Steve Jobs had all kinds of. You can also argue that even though he had this medical condition, that he kind of worked himself to death. I mean, that there's a sense that he couldn't stop. And that this sense of control of his body. He also was anorexic for part of his life. So there's he's a control freak, and that may have something to do with the medical his inability to get medical treatment when he really needed it.
That makes sense. Yeah. So I heard that after Daniel Day-Lewis did the Lincoln movie that he said that he actually sort of felt like he fell in love with Lincoln, a man he'd never met. Did you develop any sort of emotional attachment or the opposite to any of the characters you wrote about?
I love writing about these people because a biographer's job is to bring a person to life. And with an obsessive, you know what they're thinking about. You know that Melville Dewey is thinking about 10. But at this, but at the same time, you know, they'd make me laugh and they'd make me cry. I felt sorry for some of the family members, and I think I felt maybe closest to Ted Williams, not so much for the Boston connection, but he actually wrote a best-selling autobiography called My Turn at Bat that came out, was written with a ghostwriter, and it came out in 1969, in which he's very honest about his failings. He was terrible as a father. He was 0-for-3 at his children's births, and he really acknowledges that in a really in a very moving way. Most of the other people can't write about themselves. Thomas Jefferson tries to write an autobiography, and he stops in the middle. He says, I'm bored of talking about myself. And Ted Williams, there's just an emotional honesty and depth. Thomas Jefferson, as I argue, was brilliant, but he was always kind of running away from his internal life by doing something. About Estee Lauder, it was said, she relaxes by doing something else hard. You know, these folks don't know how to relax and don't know how to sit with their own thoughts and feelings, and their mega success may be a way of coping with their own thoughts and feelings, a way of running away. They run away from their inner world by building these great companies or institutions.
That was such a good example you had in the book of how Estee Lauder's kids deliberately broke something in the house so that she would have something to obsess about to distract her from worrying about her health.
Right, and that's part of it, that the family, that people who become close to these obsessives, you know, learn how to deal with them. And I think what Kit's talking about is that Estee Lauder, you know, she was about 90, and they were redoing her office, and her son, who's now a billionaire, didn't want to be bothered by her. He knew that she would start making a lot of demands. So he purposely broke something in the office, and she noticed it and said, "Oh, have them someone fix that right away," and that was the extent of her butting in. So he kind of knew how to deal with her. And again, these folks can only have happy marriages or happy families when everyone else figures out strategies, whether that's sending them to Germany like Heinz's children or breaking something like Lauder's children, some kind of strategy to sort of manage their quirkiness.
All of the characters in your book had a similarly kind of harsh, negligent sort of childhood.
Yep.
And people would probably like to hear a little bit more about that than what you described in your talk. But you might also add how they affected their kids.
Right. Yeah, one example was Melville Dewey. His mother was 42 when he was born, in around 1850, and that was very old then. His mother didn't fuss. She said, I had no time to fuss with babies. He was raised by an older sister, so he really had no early bonding with his mother. And by age 5, he was already alphabetizing the spices in his mother's pantry. He wanted to feel useful. That was his way. So these obsessions become this existential strategy for a kid to feel a sense of order and control in an environment that's very chaotic. About the children, I guess Lindbergh's interesting because Lindbergh didn't rule his American children with his fists, but with his ironclad lists. He had these 5 American children that whom he saw only 2 months a year. And remember Jefferson and his mega chart about fruits and vegetables. Lindbergh kept a mega chart on his American children of their infractions. So if they chewed gum, he put a little check mark, and then he'd give them lectures. I spoke with his American daughter, Reeve, who just felt it was ridiculous. And what's interesting about Lindbergh is with his German children, he was much sweeter. And he didn't really see them that much, but when he was with them, he was more engaged. And that's these obsessives tend to be fragmented. And the one thing that they can't deal with is daily relationship. So if he could see these kids, and he had 7 German children, if he saw them for a few weeks a year, he could be okay. He just can't sustain a deep attachment. And that's because usually something goes awry in their early bonding, and as adults, they just don't know how to connect. Instead of connecting, they tend to collect. And one of the things that the sex maniacs collect are women, but they really have trouble connecting.
Indeed. So are there any juicy tidbits that you left out of the book that you can share with us?
Juicy tidbits. Let's see. Well, one of the things I didn't say about Lindbergh, and this is a kind of laugh or cry thing, is that two of the German mistresses were sisters. So I interviewed the German son who thought that who didn't realize that his cousins were really his half-siblings.
Oh, my goodness.
And again, it's like laugh or cry. But Lindbergh's granddaughter had a sense of humor about it, and she said, well, because now the American children and the German children know each other and are friendly, and the granddaughter said, well, given what we know about Lindbergh, because he also had lovers in Africa and the Philippines, he had various other short-term lovers, given what we know now about Lindbergh, I don't know how many family, how many relatives we have. I think the laugh or cry is one way to kind of take in these folks, because it's a little bit over the top. It's really hard to digest how chaotic, and it's just so strange because they're control freaks, but their personal lives are so chaotic. But they have a sense of control. They feel as if they're in control, even if they're acting kind of wildly. And about Thomas Jefferson, there's been a debate for 200 years about whether or not he had his wife died after 10 years, and then there have been rumors that he had a relationship with a slave with whom he fathered six children. Annette Gordon Reed, a Harvard professor, won the Pulitzer Prize for documenting that relationship pretty carefully, and that relationship makes sense to me because he's a control freak, and having a second wife who's 30 years younger, whom he happens to own, is kind of a natural. And historians for two centuries said, well, Thomas Jefferson, given what we know about his character, would never do that kind of thing. But I'm saying, given what I think I've learned about his character, it may have been a natural.
Yeah, the Jefferson chapter was really incredible. I don't think most people know about that darker side of his life.
Yeah, and that's, again, not to diminish the greatness. And I think mm-hmm. we put these people on a pedestal, and that's not to diminish those 200 words in the preamble that have inspired people around the world. Those are absolutely brilliant. But just because he wrote those 200 words doesn't mean that he's a saint, and doesn't mean that the rest of his life was perfect. And we have a hard time grappling with that, and that's precisely what I want to do. Is I think we live in a culture where we have a hard time just taking in the complexity. Just think of the New York mayor's race. I mean, what do you do? Because Eliot Spitzer was a great attorney general. He was obsessed with getting the bad guys, and he got the mob, and he was very energetic. And what do you do? How do you reconcile some of the crazy behavior with some of the achievements? And I just think we need to learn how to process it, because it is around us, and we need to just think intelligently and critically about these people.
So we're all thinking too black and white, right?
I think so, yep.
Okay. So a lot of people that have obsessive features to their personality are also very superstitious. Did
yes.
you find that in your research as well?
Yeah, the superstition is part of the anxiety. Mm-hmm. You know, like a baseball player who might be an obsessive will, wear the same socks or... And by the way, Ted Williams was also a cleanliness nut. Remember Tiger Woods, a cleanliness nut. Ted Williams used to ask the Red Sox, he used to go into these intellectual discussions with the Red Sox clubhouse attendant about why he used Tide on the team's laundry. He wanted to know exactly why it was more effective. And that's this kind of anxiety and this desire for perfection. And that's part of the obsessionality.
So a couple of people are interested in knowing, first of all, how you became interested in obsessives in the first right. place, and then also what the research process was like for your book.
I want to say that I'm not an obsessive, but I'm obsessed with the obsessed. and it started with two previous books. I wrote a biography of Peter Mark Roget, the author of The Thesaurus, Roget's Thesaurus, and Noah Webster, the author of America's First Dictionary. And it made sense for those guys, if you like to obsess about words and can sit for 10 hours a day making word lists, it makes sense that you can write a great dictionary. But really blew me away is when I saw it in all these other fields. I didn't expect to find that athletes would care about cleanliness and order or politicians like Jefferson. So, and the research process, again, I would read the major biographies, and most of them would ignore this obsessionality, because we live in an age where there's so much hagiography. We just want to, if someone does great things, we assume that they're great. And then I would also do archival research, and it was thrilling. Like Boston has Thomas Jefferson's weather diary, so I could go to the Massachusetts Historical Society and touch his weather diary. Thomas Jefferson loved minutiae like Heinz, and he kept track of the weather for 50 years. And he starts in July of 1776 when he has a lot on his mind, but he decides to start taking the weather three times a day. And someone else would be relaxing with all that pressure of a war and the Declaration, but Jefferson, like a Estée Lauder, is going to do something else hard and starts becoming a weather scholar.
Interesting. What other sorts of coping strategies did you find were common to most of the obsessives?
Yeah, I think the womanizing is also kind of a coping strategy, because what they want to do is, I think that the scariest thing for them is just to sit and be, just to stop. They can't do that, so all their activity, it's a self-soothing kind of way. Thomas Jefferson would be singing. He wanted to sort of fill up his mind at all times. Some of them used alcohol, but there's this kind of massive anxiety. And what's so interesting, again, is that that at times they can take all this emotional distress and turn it into something incredible. And that's the link to Sylvia Plath, that she's taking her suicidal depression and turning it into art. But I never realized that someone could take their anxiety and turn it into a great business and turn it into the ketchup business or something like that. And that really surprised me.
Okay. All right, let me take a few more questions from the audience here. So here's somebody that's interested in the amount of energy that compulsive people have. And they're wondering to what end all that energy. In other words, is there something that we as a culture need to do to heal or to help people that are?
Yeah, it's really complicated. So they tend not to need that much sleep, except for Melville Dewey, who liked to get 10 hours a night when he could. But people like Steve Jobs, they can just go all the time. And then there's this, as I was talking with you before, Kit, that there's kind of this question of, do you want to cure them? And if you gave them a tranquilizer, would you take away the creativity? And even if you gave them good therapy, and I spoke with business consultants who work with corporate boards, would you want them to lose their maniacal edge? If making the dust inspections is going to give Steve Jobs the energy to do 10 other things, maybe you want to leave him alone. And maybe you want to give him more slack. I mean, that's kind of what Apple learned. I mean, they fired, he had that hiatus and he was being a pain, and he could be a pain, but once he's starting to do all these great things, maybe you just don't want to touch him because he's coming up with billion-dollar products. So it's really confusing, and I don't know the answer of how to treat them. These folks tend to only go into treatment, when there's a major business failure. Or whether some family member insists on it, but it's a very delicate matter because medication could probably take their energy away, and softening them might take away some of the creativity and the earning power and some of the other good things.
Do you think, from knowing your subjects as well as you do, that there are any that would have chosen to have a more peaceful existence rather than to have been able to accomplish what they did?
Yes, I mean, definitely think of someone like Ted Williams, because baseball career is over at 40.
Right.
And he actually found love. He had three wives and a lot of girlfriends. He was also a sex maniac, although he wasn't secret. He would sign baseballs and give attractive women the number of his hotel room at the Somerset Hotel in Boston. But when he was about 50, he fell in love with an older woman, about 4 or 5 years older, and he kind of chilled out and really appreciated life a little bit more and really understood connection for the first time. And I think more of them would have appreciated, but for some of them, like they just couldn't stop, and the idea of stopping is really frightening to them. But I think, you know, Ted Williams was forced to stop. I mean, although he became a great fisherman, and the fishing rod becomes like a substitute baseball bat, but there's something really sad about their lives with all the wealth, and Lindbergh was the most famous man on the planet for a while. You know, all the wealth and opportunity, they often bungled things and ended up kind of, even though he had a lot of women in his life, he was kind of lonely. And that's something that his daughter told me that was very moving. She just said, "I never realized how alone my father was." That's what she said after she found out about the German mistresses. And I think, but a lot of them are very anti-psychological. Lindbergh's wife, he drove her into psychoanalysis, and he used to yell at her for going to a therapist. And he actually, I read in his papers at Yale that he used to psychoanalyze his biographers, and he said that his biographer must have been a very unhappy man. I mean, he was really didn't want to go there. Any kind of self-reflection, it was terrifying. But sometimes once they get over the hump, like Ted Williams, they can kind of slow down a little bit and have a deeper, more connected life. It is possible.
And then, do they find peace?
I think Ted Williams, in that relationship, found really slowed down, and Ted Williams had a really hard time connecting with his fellow baseball players. The hardest thing for an obsessive is a peer relationship. So he would hang out with a clubhouse attendant so he could boss him around. But late in his life, he actually reconnected with his, if you know that book about his trip to Florida with Johnny Pesky and the other Red Sox, that bestseller by David Halberstam, that he even connected with his old baseball friends more. And he understood the importance of relationships, but often they have a really hard time ever doing that.
So in some ways, it sounds like feeling like they were mothered, as you said in the book, is the only hope for salvation, of just peace in addition to...
Yeah, because in many cases, they just don't get... Most of us learn how to relax because we're somehow comforted by someone in our life, a parent or an aunt. We learn how to feel comfortable with another person. A lot of these folks had to rely on gadgets or things as children, and unless they find that in a mothering kind of spouse it's really hard for them to ever change.
So I've got a lot of questions once again on who else you considered, and somebody wants to know, what about people in the music world?
Oh, sure. Yeah, again, I'm nervous about identifying, you know, living people, but...
it's just us here.
Yeah. Saying definitively, but as I said, we've known for a while that composers and, you know, poets and writers, and definitely people in the music field, but often people in the music field have more serious mental illnesses, like very bad depression or bipolar disorder, but there also can be obsessives who can be composers. Or someone was just telling me, I appeared on a New York radio show, and someone was telling me that Burt Bacharach was a potential candidate. He was sexually compulsive and also an order freak as well.
I have a question from somebody that would love it if you would comment on Howard Hughes a little bit.
Yes, I did. Howard Hughes kind of had obsessive compulsive personality early in his life when he was doing a lot of things, and he was a Hollywood producer and aviator. And then toward the end of his life, he had crippling OCD. Those of you who've seen the movie, he would sit naked in the middle of the hotel room in the germ-free zone and be paralyzed by OCD. So sometimes people with a personality disorder can have a touch of obsessive-compulsive disorder itself, or sometimes they can be overwhelmed by OCD. So early in his life, he had that compulsive energy, and late in his life, he was really emotionally crippled by OCD itself.
Thank you. Interesting question here. Do you think more companies should be seeking mad people for positions of leadership?
The answer is yes. I've just written a story for Fortune and the Daily Beast about how IT firms are seeking out autistics. SAP has decided that it wants 1% of its global workforce to be autistic, and it's now it's done this in Germany, and it's now hiring its first like 9 autistics in Palo Alto, and these are high functioning autistics. We used to call them Asperger. So these are people who are kind of cousins, but SAT, these people, the high functioning autistics, commonly known as ASPEs, they love to do the same thing over and over again. And if you think of SAP's business, it's software testing. And it's really, what I'm really bringing out is the question of fit. And I'm also bringing out some larger questions, is that we all have a touch of something. And maybe the challenge in life isn't for any of us to become normal, but for us to find what's a good fit for our particular quirkiness. And that people with high-functioning autistics can function better than well in the IT world. And obsessive compulsives, have this ability to be perfectionists and become great athletes or corporate leaders. And for all of us, we've got a little bit of something. And that's maybe what I'm trying to add, is this bringing in the irrational. You just feel like doing something all the time. Don't analyze it, but go for it. And if you can find a way to make a living at it, maybe you should try. But there's a lot of sense in psychiatry right now. For instance, the DSM, Psychiatry's Bible, when it looks at a disorder like autism, only lists the negative, right? It doesn't say that people with autism have the ability to do repetitive tasks time and time again. And SAP is finding is they're not doing this out of the kindness of their heart. They're doing it for the bottom line because they know that they're tapping into incredible brain power.
So let's pause for a minute and remind everybody that we're listening to Commonwealth Club radio program, and our guest is journalist Joshua Kendall, who's discussing how compulsive behavior can lead to greatness and a lot of other good stuff. You can also find video for Commonwealth Club programs online at Fora TV. All right, everybody wants to talk about sex. I have about 7 questions here related to sex, so let me give you a few of them, and you can pick what you think we'll enjoy hearing about the most. Somebody wants to know if Estee was a manonizer. Mm-hmm. Yeah, good question.
Good question. All right,
and
let me do one at a time.
Do you want to do one at a time?
Okay. Yeah.
All right.
She was married to a very sweet guy who kind of mothered her, and she found him boring. And after about 10 years of marriage, she divorced him and started manizing. And the family is very secretive, and it's hard to get the details. But they were divorced for about 4 years, and she had a bunch of often very wealthy and attractive men. But to her credit, and she, maybe like Ted Williams, did have these moments of self-reflection. To her credit, she realized that she was missing something, and she went back to her husband. And she hid that fact for many years. She was kind of ashamed of it, but it came out in the 1980s. And what's so interesting is that her son, Leonard Lauder, whom I interviewed, is a billionaire, and he's an art collector who's just given $1 billion to the Metropolitan Museum in New York, and he starts a postcard collection. And he collected 135,000 postcards. Obsessives love to collect. And he starts the postcard collection during his parents' breakup. And that shows you how this kind of family dislocation, when people aren't around, he starts to become a collector and an obsessive. Mm-hmm. All right, next sex question.
Okay. Do you think that these leaders all had high levels of testosterone, which could account for both their ambition and their hypersexuality?
Yes. That's kind of a debate in psychiatry, and it's very hard to prove. Psychiatry is very hard to prove. It's very hard to prove causes in psychiatry. So it's very hard to prove that something is genetic, and we don't have genes, but we can say where it's hard to prove environment. All I can say is that I found this pattern of harsh environments, and it still could be a genetic factor as well. And going back to the testosterone, it's very hard to prove that it wasn't just testosterone. But I tend to think that, it's hard, that just based on my reading of these people, then it had to do something with, their attachment histories, that a lot of them early in life didn't have the bonding from a particularly a mother figure, and that leads them to kind of collect a lot of women later. but testosterone could certainly be part of the mix, and it's just really hard to prove that, and they're often kind of competing theories in psychiatry, and it's just very hard to be definitive.
Mm-hmm. Was Steve Jobs
He had a lot of girlfriends, but I don't think he was, you know, quite in Lindbergh country, which is no one else is in Lindbergh country. Four families. You know, he's by himself there. But Steve Jobs was a charmer who had a bunch of girlfriends, but he wasn't. And it's not all of them are sex maniacs, but it's something that I found a bunch of times, and it does fit well. But it's not. Thomas Jefferson, I don't think, was a sex maniac.
Right. So given the sexual activity of these people and their impact on society and nation building, can you speak to the impact on evolution or passing on genes and any further influence on culture?
Okay, and yeah, maybe that's kind of another... Maybe because the testosterone is like one theory of mm-hmm. sexuality, and maybe this questioner wants to talk about sort of evolutionary, kind of Darwinian view of, and these are theories that are in the mix now. It's just really hard to prove. I don't know where you go with that data. I understand that argument. It's just something I haven't really studied, because as a biographer, my interest is what makes people tick. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to look at what their experiences were. But I have to also realize the limits of my own analysis, that it's not a hard truth. But I feel like a good biographer is like a good novelist, that there's a certain internal consistency if the biographer does a thorough job, but that can't rule out other ways of slicing human behavior, and there may be an evolutionary component to people passing on certain genes, but it's not something I studied, but I have to be open to all ways of looking at things.
Okay. And here's a question. I know you were studying American obsessives, but this person asks, are there countries that have national obsessive compulsive personality disorder? Singapore's economic success and the sterile environment and banning chewing gum, for example.
Yes, I don't want to limit obsessionality just to America. I think it's all over the place. David Beckham, for instance, the soccer star, whenever he goes into a hotel room, all the Coke cans have to be facing outward and in the refrigerator. And if you think about it, his great contribution to soccer was the corner kick, which is, he's doing the same thing over and over and over and over again. And I think there are obsessives in other cultures, and the Singapore is a good example. I've also studied Carl Linnaeus, the classification guy who gave us Homo sapiens, the Swedish guy, who also, by the way, was a sex maniac in the 18th century, which it's hard to find evidence for that, but there was some for Carl Linnaeus. So these folks can be in other cultures, but I think maybe what I was trying to capture in America is just how competitive our culture is. And there's kind of a crisis right now in that, it's kind of like if you're sane and you spend more time with your kids and your partner, it's like damaging for your career. If you're not a nut, you're harming yourself. Or if you're not, you don't act a little bit crazy. And I think maybe that's the reason I called it America's Obsessive, is that there's a kind of crisis right now with this 24/7 world where there's just so much pressure to be productive, and that there's something. America is a little bit more so in America because we have less regulation than other cultures, and we celebrate the individual more than they do in let's say Western Europe, for instance, even though there can be a lot of obsessives in Western Europe.
Mm-hmm. Well, unfortunately, I think we just have time for one more question, and I know I'm not alone in wondering what you're working on now and what we can expect next.
I'm interested in character, and my next book is about presidential character, and again, because presidents, the people who become presidents, often have you know, aren't the best adjusted, and you know what are the character types, and how does that character like I was recently at the Truman Archives, and Harry Truman was a really sweet person who was very kind to his daughter, and are people who are sweet in the family, does that mean that they can be good as presidents and be, or does it, you know, like the Elliot Spitzer example of someone who's a little bit crazy in the family, but he's really good at getting the bad guys. I mean, how does character play with achievement? So I'll be studying the presidents and grouping them by character and seeing what their character style says about their leadership style.
How are you going to go about researching?
I'm reading a lot of presidential biographies, and then I'm going I'm really thrilled about this, and it's so much fun going to various presidential libraries across the country and looking for new letters, and especially family relationships, because you learn about character by seeing how the president interacts with people to whom he's close.
And when will your book be out?
It's going to be coming out in about 2 years.
Okay, good. All right. Well, our thanks to Joshua Kendall. Mr. Kendall's a journalist, associate fellow at Yale University's Trumbull College, and author of the new book, America's Obsessives, The Compulsive Energy That Built a Nation. We also would like to thank our audience here and on the radio, television, and the internet. I'm Dr. Kit Yarrow, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned. Thank you.